Hello and welcome to the 8th episode of the Canucks Army Podcast. Joining me today are TSN fantasy analyst Scott Cullen, who recently wrote a epic Canucks off-season game plan at TSN.ca. And then we'll be joined by Corey Pronman of Hockey Prospectus and ESPN Insider to preview the draft and talk about the moribund state of the Vancouver Canucks prospect pool. We're joined now by TSN.ca analyst Scott Cullen. Scott, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you today, Thomas?
I'm well. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks so much for writing that detailed, thorough off-season game plan for the Canucks. That series must be an awful lot of work, but you're doing the Lord's work.
Well, yeah, it is a lot of work, and then as I see the draft coming on the horizon and the number of teams I have left to finish, I'm kind of jamming it in here at the end. But like you say, it's the Lord's work. You know, you get to dig into hockey stats and salaries and kind of look ahead for each team. It's a lot of work, but it's pretty fun work.
Yeah, now I'm interested, before we sort of talk about your Canucks game preview specifically, to get a sort of better handle on how you're looking at things structurally in terms of gauging what a team should do going forward. For example, with the Canucks, you know, they're pressed up against the cap. Their general manager, though, has sort of promised the fan base a reset in a sort of a multiple public statements. And then they've got, significant holes through their lineup that they'll actually have to, you know, find good depth players to fix. How do you sort of balance those different factors when putting together a game plan?
Well, it's hard because, the hardest thing that I find is if they're planning on making some trades, and it's hard to project what kind of trade could be made and what you might get in return. Like when I've done the Canucks offseason game plan and I come together with a roster, I've wiped Roberto Luongo off the team somehow, some way they're going to get rid of him. But I really don't have anything coming back in return for Roberto Luongo. And, mm-hmm. and maybe they won't have any tangible, you know, active player coming back to the roster. But maybe they will. And I just, you know, you don't know where he's going and you don't know what's going to come back. And so it gets hard to kind of balance what pieces you're going to get through that. So a lot of times when I'm compiling the kind of a projected roster for next season, and I'm looking at the few prospects that might have a chance, looking at some free agents that might be able to fit some of those holes. Those are kind of the guys that I'm looking to add, and I'm recognizing that, look, if you decide that you're going to make a, you know, if moving Luongo brings in a piece, or if you decide you're going to trade a core player and that's going to, you know, shake things up more, I totally recognize that those things are possible. It's just very difficult to project if a team's going to make those kinds of moves. And it gets more challenging, too, when you have Gillis saying that, oh, you know, they want to make changes, they want to reset and so on. And then you see the kind of financial situation that Canucks are in. And, you know, it doesn't seem that it's that easy to reset the team, you know, unless you're going to start moving core guys. I mean, if you already go into the off season with the idea that, you know, you're getting rid of Luongo and, you know, maybe a bio for Keith Ballard, well, you know, then, you know, what else are you doing to, you know, that's just barely getting you enough room to maneuver under the cap to begin with. You know, that doesn't mean you're suddenly, you know, chock full of money to start throwing around at anybody who comes available. And so that, you know, becomes, you know, in my view of the Canucks, I think it ends up being more tinkering, and maybe Gillis has other plans, but that's, you know, just my view from it on the outside is that I don't see a ton of room to make changes.
Yeah, I think many realistic Canucks fans would agree with you, but I also think that they'd look at your off-season game plan and at least superficially be underwhelmed, especially considering the biggest additions you see the club making are of the Chad LaRose, Grant Klitsam variety. What's the ceiling of a Canucks team that tinkers over this offseason, going forward in a reformed Western Conference competing with the likes of San Jose and Los Angeles?
Well, I guess that's, you know, it's a question of, you know, whether you think they're better than they showed in a 48-game season this year. I think, you know, that if you've got the Sedins and you've got a healthy Kessler, you know, that's a different animal than what you had this year, because really they spent most of the year playing without a second-line center, at least not a real legitimate second-line center. And look, when Ryan Kessler's healthy, he's, you know, a top-tier second-line center, you know. And that to me, makes a, you know, significant difference in what they can be as a team. But, you know, what's their ceiling? You know, I think the ceiling is, well, going to be based on, A, whether all those guys stay healthy, and then B, whether, you know, Corey Schneider, you know, give him the number one job and he gets 60-plus starts, is Corey Schneider still, you know, stopping 92 to 93% of the shots he faces? Like, if he's, you know, a really high-end goaltender, then, yeah, I think the Canucks' ceiling is still really high. But if, you know, if guys are getting hurt and Schneider maybe isn't, you know, doesn't make this transition to the number one job that everyone kind of thinks he can make, well, then, you know, then it becomes maybe just a battle to make the playoffs. And so I think that's where their range is, somewhere between playoff team and then still a cup contender. But I know, you know, when I say that you're adding the likes of Chandler Rose and Grant Clipson, that doesn't exactly inspire confidence they're going to be much better next season.
Yeah, and yet, you know, while you don't see the team making any big additions, you do have the club going with youth in critical roles, which I suppose could be part of, you know, that could at least be sold to the fan base as a reset. Is this based more on their cap situation, in your view, or necessity?
Well, a little bit of both. I think the cap situation might lean you towards giving a few younger guys a shot, and you know, whether I projected Brendan Gaunce to make the team, and that could be optimistic. I realize that. you know, it's a big jump for anybody to go straight from juniors to the NHL. But you know, as a young guy who's big and you know, might be able to play a bit of a physical game that Gillis seems to want, I at least give him a shot to do that. You know, and now on the other hand, I also have Jordan Schrader on the team, and he's not real big and not real physical, but you know, a young guy who is probably relatively inexpensive and didn't look, you know, terribly out of place last year. I do think that, you know, part of the deal is that look, if you have the money to spend, you can go get a big proven guy to go in and play those roles, you do it. Because, you know, what I see with the Canucks is there's you know, kind of a limited window here for that you're still going to have the Sedins as, you know, top level producers. And, you know, maybe that window closes 2 years from now. Maybe it closes 4 years from now. Maybe it closes after next season. Like, you know, once you start hitting into your mid-30s, those things can start to drop off, no matter how good you are. And to me, once the Sedins are no longer, you know, point per game guys, then you know it becomes a real challenge to consider the Canucks as contenders. And unless there's kind of a real regeneration that goes with the roster, and other guys can step into those roles. But so I kind of see it as, there is a bit of urgency to take advantage of what you have there now. But, I mean, we could be looking a year from now going, all right, it's time to make changes because it just didn't work.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the Sedins' performance over the 48-game season and the four games they played in the playoffs. You know, with less center depth on the team, they were relied on sort of in a different way than they'd been in the past and sort of turned in a pretty excellent season by the underlying numbers, but they left a lot of observers, Canucks fans who are just watching with their eyes, a little bit cold. I'm curious to hear what you think about, you know, their projection going forward.
Well, I would still be, you know, pretty high on them, expecting, you know, point per game-ish kind of numbers. I look at, you know, what Daniel, you know, had a low shooting percentage this year, the kind of thing that, you know, would tend to bounce back based on historical numbers for him. So, and as you say, the underlying numbers, I mean, the one thing that's always been interesting, right, is how Vigneault would deploy them, you know, always giving them more work in the offensive zone. And I guess you'll wonder whether, you know, a new coach comes in and whether they will get that same kind of tilt towards the offensive zone in how they're used. But, you know, taking you know, that for what it's worth, whether a guy, you know, starts 65% or 55% in the offensive zone, you still think they're going to be the focal point of the Vancouver offense, and I still think that they're guys who can kind of control play offensively. And I think part of the problem with not having Kessler is that they just didn't have enough support otherwise. And that if you have Kessler healthy for a full season, and look, Kessler, you know, when he hasn't been hurt, has been a pretty productive goal scorer. That he's not just the checker that he kind of was as he came up. That he's really become a huge threat for them offensively. And if you have that on another line, that tends to take some pressure off the guys on the number one line. So I wouldn't be too down on the Citadins for what they did last season. No one's going to get real praise for getting swept out of the first round. So
yeah,
that criticism is going to fall pretty much throughout the roster. You're obviously not thrilled with how that went for them, but at the same time, they're not alone in taking criticism for that.
Yeah. Now, we described your off-season plan for the Canucks as superficially underwhelming based on some of the additions that you have the team making. But on the other hand, you did have the Canucks ridding themselves of the onerous cap commitments to Keith Ballard and Roberto Luongo. If Mike Gillis and the Canucks hit a couple of singles on the trade market or the open market this summer, but managed to completely clear the decks, should that be seen as a win?
I think so.
I think
so,
too.
You know, and I don't know whether everybody else is going to be satisfied with, you know, just clearing the decks and giving yourself some financial flexibility going forward. But I think, the Roberto Luongo contract is strange because, look, he's certainly good enough to play as a starting goalie in the NHL, but I understand why you don't want to hang on to this guy, you know, through the life of that contract. If you don't want to hang on to him through the life of the contract, finding another team that wants to take him through the life of the contract isn't easy either. And so I can understand why this has kind of played out longer than anticipated. But, you know, let's make the assumption that at some point this summer, they can get the job done and clear that contract out of there and presumably buy out Ballard because it just hasn't worked out for him in Vancouver. Well, you know, now that kind of gives you a little more leeway going forward with for player acquisitions. And as you say, it was kind of underwhelming on what I projected for them this year. But you know, if you've got the financial flexibility for future years, that there's value in that. And you know, it's somewhat underwhelming to say that your value is your cap flexibility. But when you use that cap flexibility to acquire players down the road, it's not so underwhelming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you went by example, say when the Boston Bruins traded Joe Thornton, right, the return they got for Joe Thornton was nothing special. Mm-hmm. Marco Sturm, Andrew Ferentz, that was a subsequent trade. What they really got out of that was that they got some gap room, and they turned around and they used it to go, fill out a roster with Zdeno Chara and things like that. So sometimes having cap room is worthwhile as long as you use it for the right acquisitions down the road.
Yeah, as long as you don't use it on a Keith Ballard trade. Now, Keith Ballard, I'm curious to hear a totally objective assessment of this because there's been some rumblings in the Vancouver market that the team is reluctant to buy out Keith Ballard, which, looking at it structurally, that makes no sense. But there's been some rumblings that they'd prefer to retain his salary in a transaction. Keith Ballard obviously has negative trade value at $4.2 million for the next couple of years. At $2.1 million, does Keith Ballard have some value based on the way we've seen, based on the dearth of options available in free agency for defensemen, and based on the cost of defensemen on even the RFA market?
You know what, that's at $2.1 million, that's an interesting possibility, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I think you would have to find somebody who has a history with Keith Ballard and can kind of overlook almost what's happened in Vancouver and say, you know what, I remember, when we had him in Florida or played against him when he was with Florida and that was a guy who was tough to play against and played 22 minutes a night. And, even if you don't think that Keith Ballard is, going to return to being a 22-minute night defenseman, if you think he can play for you in your top six on a regular basis, maybe you're willing to pay $2.1 million for that. And particularly because, there's just a couple of years left on his deal where, if you're going out to get a free agent defenseman, you're probably going to have to pay, either you're paying more than $2.1 million or, B, you're giving more than 2 years' term.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see how that's a possibility you can find somebody who is willing to overlook the last three seasons of Keith Ballard's existence. That becomes kind of, finding the right fit and the right guy. And maybe they can do that. I say that's the kind of thing you explore it. And then if really no one's biting, then maybe you have to resign yourself to the buyout.
Yeah. And I do think the buyout will come. eventually for Keith Ballard. So penciling Brendan Gaunce and Jordan Schrader into the bottom six of Vancouver's forward group, especially at center, I'm curious to ask you about the concept of Kessler insurance, which we've been writing about a bunch at Canucks Army. Can the Canucks afford to go into next season, you know, possibly the last of their realistic championship window, relying on a guy like Gaunce in a top nine role, especially when you consider Kessler's recent durability issues? Is there a player on the market that the Canucks could affordably acquire who could credibly play in their top six if Kessler went down without the team, basically suffering the fate they did this year with the likes of Schrader, Ebbett, and LaPierre down the middle?
Well, yeah, I think there probably are. If you want to, you know, grab a veteran guy and you have to obviously find one who's somewhat reasonably priced, and, you know, maybe it's, you know, one of the guys that I look at is, Matt Cullen, from Minnesota, and he's 36 and you know, he made $3.5 million last year. I don't know whether you can get him for less than that. I think at 36, if you gave him a 2-year deal, you might be able to get him for $3 million or even under that. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But he had a pretty good year this year for Minnesota. Minnesota, kind of was going in the tank until their second line, started to produce for them. And that was Cullen with Devin Setoguchi and Jason Zucker for a long stretch. And then Pierre-Marc Richard. Mm-hmm. But, he's the kind of guy. Cullen has been a third line center for the vast majority of his career. But he has a little bit of that upside where he can slide in and he play power play, played the point on the power play quite a bit throughout his career too. And if that's the kind of guy that if you're thinking you're a championship team and I do think that the Wild might be in a bit of a cap situation where they can't afford to keep Cullen, which he's a Minnesota native, he was thrilled to go there, and I can understand why they might want to keep him, but I also think that they could be in a tough spot to try and pay him that kind of money. So if the Canucks decide that they want to more insurance for Kessler, and I can see that being a totally reasonable approach to take, and certainly, if you give Brendan Gaunce another year or 2 years to develop into an NHL player, that probably doesn't hurt him any. Mm-hmm. Matt Cullen might be the kind of guy that I would look at. But again, it depends on what guys are asking him for agency. Maybe Matt Cullen thinks he deserves a raise on $3.5 million because he had a good season. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and he might get a raise on $3.5 million even if he'd had a bad season. Just as a consolation prize for the Ribeiro sweeps.
Yeah, sure. Look, there are plenty of kind of interesting centers out there who can provide secondary offense. Like in Vancouver had one there, Derek Roy. But I understand that if you're looking to, if your team wants to get bigger, keeping Derek Roy around probably isn't the way to go about it. And I liked the acquisition of Roy when they got him from Dallas because of the way he had, Dallas had been using him a lot of defensive zone starts for a guy of his track record as an offensive player. I don't think it was terribly overwhelming what he did in Vancouver. So I understand that, that they're going to look to other options and probably guys who might make a little bit less. And, so you're going to see Ribeiro's probably the guy who commands the most. But then you've got those consolation prizes of Roy and Steven Weiss and Valtteri Filppula and, maybe Matt Cullen. But,
Yeah.
Some of those guys are probably going to get a pretty decent payday just for being, a secondary option.
Yeah, absolutely. So, finally, I'd ask your thoughts on Chris Tanev, and more importantly, the way the restricted free agent market for defensemen has gone so far this summer in terms of Yossi. We saw Voinov yesterday. Seems like these guys are getting pretty big paydays, and that the PK Subban comparable isn't particularly bothering them much.
No, and it's real interesting. Depending on the team, you can find a team, like Montreal really drew a line in the sand with Subban last year and almost forced that that contract through. He had to miss time before it got done and all that. Mm-hmm. But then you have a lot of other teams that are pretty willing to make the investment in a young defenseman, maybe buy out a few years of unrestricted free agency like the Kings did with Voinov. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I think if I'm the Canucks, I would take a harder line with Tanev because he just doesn't have the track record yet. I think a lot of people are positive about what they've seen out of Chris Tanev, and I think, you know, this past season he played, you know, most of the year before getting hurt late, and you know that was kind of a promising sign that he'd be a regular part of the blue line. But I think they shouldn't have to pay through the nose to keep him this year. I think, you know, even if you just gave him, you know, whatever the bare minimum is to get through for another season, that'd probably be how I'd do it. And particularly given the Canucks' financial situation, they're probably not in a position to start throwing around a long-term deal for Tanev just yet.
You know, I saw your $1 million figure yesterday. And I sort of chuckled. I was like, man, there's no way he's going to get way more than that. And then I was sort of perusing CapGeek because they reported the Patrick Mullin signing. They had it confirmed. Matthew West had it confirmed long before anyone else did. And I see Marco Scandella, 2 years, $2.05 million in Minnesota. And, I mean, the numbers are extremely close between those two players. So I actually think your $1 million might be a pretty good ballpark figure. Despite the knee-jerk reaction I had to it.
No, and look, the whole issue with any of those restricted guys when you're projecting is how long is the deal going to get signed for?
Yeah.
You know, if the team decides that they're going to, you know, invest several years on it and it might buy out unrestricted years or something like that, well, then it totally changes the, mm-hmm. you know, what the cap number is. And I recognize that, but I guess in giving Tanev only $1 million, which admittedly I don't, I do a quick kind of throw a number at the wall kind of thing with those guys. I
yeah.
You know, break down 12 comparables and see how it works out. It's, and so if it's $1 million or $1.2 million or, you know, whatever it's going to be, I'm just throwing a ballpark number up there. And so I, you know, if my position basically is that, yes, they should take a bit of a hard line with Tanev this year and let him, you know, play a full season, you know, 80 games and see what you have at the end of the year, and then be prepared then that, you know, maybe then it's going to be time to pay the piper for Chris Tanev.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks so much, Scott. Actually, you know what? Before we go, I better ask you about coaching. Otherwise, my listeners will tell me to talk more about coaching. Pierre LeBrun reported there's a short list of four, Scott, including Scott Arneil. I'm curious to hear, how do you rate Scott Arneil's work with Columbus?
Boy, I don't know. I guess underwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, the Blue Jackets weren't great, but you know, it's hard to. I really have a hard time separating the coach from the goaltender, right?
You know, I know.
Like when we talked about the coach of the year this year, you know, and everybody thought Paul McLean, it's certainly a worthy choice given the injuries and so on. But my position on it was, well, I mean, his goaltender stopped 94% of their shots. Like Craig Anderson was so amazing when he was there, and then Robin Leonard kind of didn't drop off any when he came up. That, you know, it was hard. It's hard for me to gauge. Okay, well, who's doing the job as the coach, and really, is it just, you know, he got fortunate goaltending? And so, you know, by the opposite angle with Scott Arneil in Columbus, you know, was he a bad coach, or did he just have Steve Mason stopping 90% of the shots?
Yeah.
You know, for several years, and, you know, it's tough for anybody to win under those circumstances. So, you know, he's a guy who probably would be happy to have a second chance somewhere else and given a different opportunity. That's kind of my take on Scott Arneil. I wouldn't write off. I wouldn't want to write off anybody based on performance with a bad goaltender for a few years.
Yeah, he the Columbus PDO was 97-point-something when Scott Arneil lost his job, and actually, when you look at the work that he did to their underlying numbers, he improved a lot on what Ken Hitchcock got out of that team in his first season. And once they fired him, their numbers dropped off to like 44%. What about the rest of the short list? Lindy Ruff, do you think the game has passed Lindy Ruff by?
Interestingly, and with Lindy Ruff, he became so much kind of a fixture of Buffalo and what they did that, you know, I don't know, you know, does he fit with the new team? Like, I'm sure the chance will come at some point because, mm-hmm. you know, if you coach as long as he has, somebody will give you that chance. But I don't look at Lindy Ruff and think, okay, he's the answer to what you need. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. Like, to me, he's kind of a guy, you know.
Yeah.
He's had some success in Buffalo, you know, relative, you know, he had a team that could have been a Stanley Cup winner, you know, based on, you know, that year they lost out to Carolina. They had like five of their defensemen were injured for that series. It was kind of ridiculous. They were favored going in and then couldn't keep anyone healthy.
Yeah.
You see what he has there in his track record that, you know, somebody is going to give him a chance, but I would just kind of think of him as a guy.
Yeah, it would be funny in sort of an odd couple kind of way to see him interacting with the progressive front office that the Canucks have. What about John Tortorella, the most controversial candidate?
Obviously controversial, and from media perspective, everybody wants to see it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Vancouver, you know, is very, a heavy media market that Tortorella isn't going to be getting free passes there.
Yeah, and the fans are so angry.
What's that?
The Canucks fans are so angry. So it's like combining angry Canucks fans with John Tortorella, with the Vancouver media who have their own reputation. I mean, it just sounds like the most fun ever.
It does, and for that reason, you know, and from a distance here, where it'd be nice, kind of a show to watch. It'd be all right. And look, I don't know why John Tortorella turned the New York Rangers into, you know, this defensive shell team. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe at some point he thought that was the best way to go with his personnel. I would hope that if he came to Vancouver, he would recognize that his team doesn't have to, you know, be all about shot blocking, that they can go on the attack. And you know, look, shot blocking has its role, and that's fine. But I think if you have talented players, you turn them loose. And that's what Tortorella did in Tampa Bay way back when. And why you know, he's changed from that, I don't know. And I think if they're going to hire him, you would want assurances that, you know, you're going to keep this team on the attack rather than, waiting back to block a million shots.
Yeah, and I'd bet those are insurances that Gillis wants. You know, he's basically on the record having disliked the way the Rangers have played. So, you know, I'm sure that came up pretty quickly. Finally, John Stevens. What are your thoughts on John Stevens? I don't really know that much about him, but
a ton about John Stevens, but I thought he wasn't bad in his time with Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And again, almost like Arneil, a guy who I think is probably going to get another chance, and you know, is due to see what he can do in a new location. And I think he's also been fairly highly regarded. I think with what he's done with the Kings as an assistant. So I think. I don't have any kind of grand answer that yes, John Stevens is totally the guy you're looking for. if they decide to choose that John Stevens is their choice, I wouldn't have any problem with that. I think he's kind of well worth another shot as a head coach.
Yeah, he certainly seems like an intelligent guy. Hey, thanks so much, Scott, and great work on your off-season game plan.
Hey, thanks a lot, Thomas.
All right, all the best. We're joined now by Corey Pronman of Hockey Prospectus and ESPN Insider. Corey, I just note, is joining us a week in advance because he gets a wee bit busy around draft time. How are you today, Corey?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So we've got the draft coming up in a couple weeks. We're ramping up our coverage. I'm sure you'll be busy. What can we expect from you content-wise? I'll give you an opportunity to plug yourself over the next couple weeks.
Well, for the rest of, I guess, the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be rolling out my draft series on Hockey Prospectus. It's going to be my top 100 scouting reports on the top prospects in the 2013 draft. Separate calls, I think, are going to come out. I'm still working that out right now. I'm probably going to do a mock draft in the week leading up to the draft. I might do something on what I think Colorado should do with the number one pick, which players I hear might go up or down based on industry buzz. And just basically, I might profile why this is a deep draft. But yeah, we're going to see how everything plays out and if any other storylines pop up.
All right, so let's turn to the Canucks specifically. That's what most of our listeners are interested in. The Canucks have the 24th pick at this year's draft, but it might not matter based on their draft record. How would you evaluate the Canucks system at the moment?
It's definitely below average, if not well below average. I think once the draft comes and goes, when you see a team like Carolina or Colorado get top picks, I think they're probably going to basically slide safely into the bottom tier of NHL prospect pools. I see a couple of good prospects in that system. Nicholas Jensen, Frankie Corrado are definitely the ones that stand out for me. And of course, you have guys like Brendan Gaunce, who's certainly an above average guy. And you can throw a couple other names in there as well. But I mean, most NHL organizations have several good prospects, and I think that the quality depth in Vancouver system is lacking, and they don't have that high-end guy as well. So for the moment, I think they're probably a bottom five system in the NHL.
Now, you had Frankie Corrado as one of your highest risers in a recent, you know, prospects who've sort of improved their stock over the course of the year column quite recently. What impresses you about Frankie Corrado, and how close do you think he is to contributing in a meaningful way in the NHL?
I don't really, we saw at the end of the season he was able to, you know, handle the NHL okay when he came up after his junior year ended, and he was playing, I think he played in the playoffs with Vancouver. Again, I wouldn't say he's been a dramatic riser, but I have him as my number three Vancouver prospect last summer, ahead of Kevin Connaughton, who Vancouver traded for Derek Roy. But he's continued to be impressed a lot. I think he's definitely a top defense prospect in the NHL prospect world right now. He's just developed so well in terms of his overall game, but I think he's starting to flash a little more offensive ability too. And that was really the one big question mark with him. It was we knew he had the great hockey sense and skating and was able to shut down guys, but could he play, say, a second power play in the NHL? And I think definitely he has that projection to do that right now.
All right, so, you know, the Canucks have sort of been an odd drafting team, especially the last couple of years with their focus on overage players and, you know, a variety of sort of, they're playing at a weird angle that we don't quite understand yet, or certainly I don't quite understand yet. How would you evaluate sort of whatever game they're playing at the moment?
I find it really hard to evaluate, I guess, drafting groups a couple of years out, and I don't want to make it seem like a cop-out answer, but it's really hard for me to understand what their strategy is, what information they're going on, why they're choosing these guys. I mean, I noticed the overagers, but I mean, I think the Alexander Mallett pick from last year is the one I think you're specifically referring to that kind of stands out on that front. But I don't really see a trend specifically. The only one I really have ever really noticed that it has been a while since they've really picked a defenseman high. I think they tend to prefer forward safe at the top of the draft. But it's hard for me to evaluate, but there's just so much we don't know about why they're making these decisions.
Yeah. For sure. So, you know, there's a couple drafting patterns that we can see from Mike Gillis's 5 years. And, you know, it's still not a long enough track record to really pull much meaningfully, especially because he's traded away so many of his picks. But, you know, we've seen, for example, he's never drafted anything but a forward in the first round. What do you think of that sort of approach, for example?
If I was running a management team or a draft team, that would kind of be my suggestion as well. Even though, obviously, I do, even if you look at my draft board, I have a lot of defensemen high on my draft board. Given how I usually tend to prefer when they're close, the forward to the defenseman. So, based on how my boards usually pan out, I would guess if I would always be advocating for a forward at my draft board, just because that's probably how I would fit the rankings around. I think it's a wise decision. I think forwards tend to have a much higher hit rate compared to defensemen at the top of the draft. Even though I think there's a plausible argument, if you hit on a defenseman outside of the top 10, you could probably get a ton of more value. There tends to be much more uncertainty there. I think the ideal draft strategy is to go with a forward in the mid to late first round, which is where the Canucks have tended to pick in recent years, and then go a defenseman if you can take shots in the second, third, and fourth. Now, that's not always ideal. It depends how the draft pans out and who's left. But in based on just a ton of historical evidence, the forward tends to be the much wiser choice, all things considered, in the first round.
Yeah, another thing they've done up until last year is that in four of the five drafts they've had, they've picked a goalie at some point in the draft. Earliest was David Honzik in the third round, which was obviously a bit of a disaster pick at 71 overall in 2011. But, you know, Joe Cannata in the sixth round, they picked Morgan Clark in the fifth round. They've sort of picked a goalie each year to try and shore up their depth. What do you think of that approach?
I don't mind that. I mean, I definitely do not advocate picking a goalie high in the draft, top two, three rounds, unless they're a special goalie, but they usually won't last that long based on how the industry usually evaluates goaltenders. I don't mind picking them late. I think that's what you got to do. You find a guy who you really like, you take a shot at him. But I guess with the issue with Vancouver, outside, I mean, a guy like Joe Cannata has done well. The guy they took in the sixth round in 2009, but with others' picks it's been kind of a thrown away draft pick, more or less, which is what happens with goaltenders. I mean, you're going to miss a lot on them, but you hope that if you keep reaching for that kind of position, that you hit them on them a couple of times, so you don't have to keep using a pick over again to build your organizational depth at that position.
Why don't I say some names and you tell me if you think they'll be around by the 24th pick in this draft, and perhaps give us your evaluation of them. Are you down with this?
Sure.
Adam Earn.
I've heard there's a possibility he could slide. Based on the talent level, I'd say he should be going around the, 16 to 20 range. But there's been some concerns talking to scouts about some off-ice stuff that happened with him in Quebec. He was supposed to be suspended, and then he wasn't, and there was some team chemistry issues with him and the rest of the Ramparts. It's a little bit of a long story, but the point being that I think because of that, there's a chance he slides a little bit towards 25 range, but I wouldn't bank on him. But if he doesn't, I mean, he's a great player, high-end speed, great power game, a real good power forward, has skill. I mean, this is a guy who's one of the better prospects coming out of Q. Well, obviously not one of the best, but one of the better ones when you look at his 16- and 17-year-old season combined in a couple of years. And, I mean, he would be a great pick if he got that low.
All right. What about Frédéric Gauthier?
Gauthier, I think, is going to be there. I know Central has him rated high, but I'm not feeling that kind of optimism from the guys I talked to. If anything, it's more pessimism than optimism. I think this is a guy, he's a big man who can skate well and has some offensive ability. But I think there's just some concerns about exactly how high his offensive upside is. I know he scored a lot with Rimouski. I think he was like a point a game, but he was like, I think also he was like 6th or 7th in scoring on that team, only about 2 shots a game. And overall, he just seems to be very inconsistent with how he looks offensively game to game. And he doesn't really show that high level of physicality, even though he is a big guy. I think it's possible he slides to the end of the first round, if not even there's a chance into the beginning of the second.
What about Robert Hagg, who, you know, I ask about because he's a Moto product, and Moto and Vancouver have some historic links.
Right. Robert Hagg, he was a guy who I've heard varying, thoughts on from scouts. I've heard from some pro scouts who have him a top 15 guy, and others who think he's more into the mid to high second round. My thought is I think he'll be right around that Vancouver pick range, which would be around 25. But after his lackadaisical under-18 tournament in April, I think there's a chance he might not even go at that range. But I think in terms of Vancouver's possibility of taking him, I think Hag will still be around that range.
And let's go with one more. Let's go Jacob Rose.
Jacob De La Rose. He's also a guy who I've heard varying reports on. I think I've heard from some scouts who love the guy, who also think he's a potential top 15 pick. As much love there's even more hate, I would suppose, because I've heard from some who don't think he's a top 2-round player. That's the big, discrepancy on his offensive upside from talking to scouts. So they're not sure, is this guy a top 6 forward or a checker? In my opinion, I haven't rated my first round. I think he's scoring 4. I think he has a great power game, great skater, and has top 6 offensive upside. But I'm not sure where he's going to go. But in terms of Vancouver's pick, I'm not saying it's likely he's going to be there, but I think there's a decent chance he would be.
Yeah. So, based on your draft board and your understanding of the needs of the Canucks prospect pool, who would you think that the team should target, just like as a blank slate question?
I don't really see a specific, glaring need. Like I said, they don't really have a tremendous organization in terms of prospect depth. And that's the nicest way of saying they have a lot of needs. that's kind of it. On defense, you lost Kevin Connaughton, but you still have Corrado. You still have, you have Tanev, who's coming to his own. Don't really have a whole bunch of other guys there. At forward, you have Jensen and Schrader and Gones. Rodin's obviously leaving. LeBate's coming along. Grenier still probably looks a little bit away. So, at this point, I would probably just advise them to take the best player available.
Yeah. A couple guys who didn't get signed to entry-level deals who were drafted in 2011 and will re-enter the draft, you know, who I think highly of. I figured I might get you to tell us a bit more about them. In particular, Vancouver product Brandon Ewan, who didn't get signed by the Winnipeg Jets, mobile defenseman. What are your thoughts? Will he go in the first three or four rounds this year?
You said Brendan or Zach Ewan?
Oh, sorry, Zach Ewan, excuse me.
I want to make sure we were clear on that.
Yeah.
Zach Ewan, I was a little bit surprised he wasn't signed, especially since Winnipeg has a lot of contract room, and I thought he played well these last two seasons since he was drafted. He's gotten a lot of minutes for Tri-City. He's definitely looked like a quality defenseman in the WHL. He doesn't have a ton of upside, and I think that was kind of the primary concern. This is not a guy who's going to play on an NHL power play or be a primary puck mover for you. Just, you know, he's an average-sized guy, skates well, makes the stops, makes the smart plays, could be a third-pairing defenseman for you down the line. I wouldn't be surprised if he's a late-round pick. I've heard from one NHL scout who kind of characterized him. That's where he would kind of take him in the fifth to seventh round, somewhere around there. I think he'll get redrafted, but I don't think he'll be a hot pick.
And what about Alan Quine, Brendan Gaunce's teammate with Belleville?
Right, Alan Quine was probably one of the more surprising no signs, if not the most surprising. But I think part of that would be the fact that Detroit's at 48 contracts already for next season. Or they will be a big sign, most of their RFAs. And I think that definitely played into it. He definitely panned out really well. I mean, when he was drafted in 2011, he was seen as a toolsy project pick. And a kind of guy who needed a lot of time to develop his game. And I think he did this year. Especially when he started off the season, he had mononucleosis. He was just okay. And then when he got traded to Belleville, he really took off. And he looked like it was all coming together for him. He's a great offensive player, great skater, great hands, can make plays with a puck, definitely has top six offensive upside, and I think he definitely is going to be redrafted. I think he might even be a top three-round pick.
Lots of defensive ability, too. He seemed to do a lot of the heavy lifting on that Belleville team. So let's finish off with a question about Gaunce. Gaunce has been a pretty consistent, even-strength point producer in the OHL. Some knocks on his skating. You know, there's whispers in the Vancouver market that he's going to be given every opportunity to win the third line center job at training camp, you know, this fall. Is that too soon for him? Do you think he's ready to step into the NHL in a top nine role?
Well, I think, yeah, that probably sounds a little accelerated for me, especially since you're still U20. Vancouver's not exactly a bottom feeder. They're trying to compete. And I think that kind of even raises the expectations a little more. Trying to be a top nine player on a good team is different than trying to be a top nine player on, you know, on say Edmonton or Calgary. I don't see that. I think you probably go out in a free agency and try and find that option or give Schrader an expanded opportunity. I would always say to be cautious with U20 kids, especially with CHLers who don't have much pro experience, and I would not advise putting him in the NHL in a full-time role next year.
In terms of his skill level, though, do you think he's close?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about Gaunce is that he was one of the more pro-ready prospects coming out of the 2012 draft, so I wouldn't be shocked if he was in the NHL next year. That's just my philosophy. I don't like rushing kids. I like patience. Mm-hmm. But he's a very good two-way guy. I think he's developed physically. I think those qualities are there to make the jump. Those are usually some of the things you look for. Can you play in a pro system? Can you handle the physical rigors, the checking, et cetera? So I think it's plausible. I don't think he would be completely overwhelmed, but I just probably wouldn't advise it.
All right. Hey, Corey, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
All the best. Cheers. And that's a wrap for the 8th episode of the Canucks Army Podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and join us again next week when we'll talk coaching and the draft and buyouts and the fact that nothing ever changes in Canucks Stan. All right, all the best. Cheers.